measurable interest, as in what is best for the genetic evaluation of beef cattle. And our recommendations, as we begin to finish those up over the summer, will focus on that core mission. So the current situation, admittedly, the infrastructure for collecting feed intake across the U.S. or across North America is increasing, and there's no doubt about that. But still, relative to other production traits, things like weight traits or even ultrasonic proxies of carcass merit, feed intake is still relatively sparse. And so we have to realize that although our capacity to collect this is increasing, for at least the foreseeable future, it will not be as densely collected as what we find in other traits that enter into national cattle evaluation. And again, relatively speaking, it is expensive compared to some of those other phenotypes. As more cattle move through a collection facility in a given period of time, so conditional on some length of time, the cost per test or per animal inherently declines. So if we can decrease the cost and also increase the number of records we have, obviously that aids us in utilizing that in terms of genetic improvement. Testing more animals will allow, consequently, then, for more candidates for selection and increase intensity, and we'll show you later how that increases genetic response. And the other thing that obviously I alluded to earlier is we have a plethora of growth phenotypes in the beef cattle industry throughout all of our breed organizations. That's something we do quite well, is measuring birth weight, weaning weight, and yearling weight, and as a consequence, getting post-weaning gain. And so as the committee discussed and as literature would suggest, we have the opportunity to leverage that in getting at selecting for improved feed efficiency in beef cattle. So as Mark already went through, the BIF guidelines, a 70-day test with 21 days of warm-up really towards acclimation. And the length is principally due, the length of test is principally due to the length of time required to accurately measure gain. And we're going to show you some data that supports that as well. So when you take those things into account, if we want to just measure feed intake, we believe we can shorten up the length of test and decouple the measurement of feed intake and weight or gain on test, and instead leverage the large amount of weight data that we already have coming into national cattle evaluation. So this decoupling principle, which goes along with shortening the length of test, does perhaps interfere or at least change the paradigm of residuals, be it residual feed intake or residual average daily gain, in the way we have traditionally thought about them. We can still get at some of those things, but not in the same way that we've traditionally thought about them when we're measuring both the same time on test. So a bit of a literature review, and we're only going to go over a couple of more recent papers, but there's certainly other literature that supports some of these conclusions as well, and this is a bit more detail about what Mark just talked about, a relatively recent paper that came out of Colorado State, where they looked at different subsets of length of test, the full length of 70 days, and then from there, 8 different subsets that essentially parse it in weekly intervals, or 2-week intervals. But the nice thing about what this group did is they also looked at it from both directions, so bidirectional, removing changing the test length as well. And really what they were able to find out, and I recognize that this may be a bit hard to read, what you see here is the different subset, so day 0 to 14, 0 to 28, 0 to 42, 0 to 56, and then 14 to 70, 28 to 70, 42 to 70, and 56 to 70 days. These are regression coefficients. They're appropriate standard errors, the R-squared values, and then 2 different correlation estimates. And really, these on the far end here are rank correlations. And whichever one of these you look at really doesn't matter. They're going to be pretty much identical.
The take home from this, though, is if you look at where we see the largest regression coefficients, and this is the full 70-day test regressed on the subset, we see large regression coefficients at for dry matter intake around day 42. Both the Pearson and the rank correlations really approaching one here at 0.97. So really it looks like 42 days, certainly adequate at least from this study at being able to accurately measure dry matter intake. And then you can also look at residual feed intake over here. And as you might expect, the same story holds true, that we begin to do that fairly accurately in 42 days on test. Now, one thing that's important to realize is that RFI, what goes into that, is more than just dry matter intake to get the prediction equation. And so looking at things like average daily gain and metabolic midweight on test, we see a slightly different story here. Again, the same kind of parameters we're looking at, and really at using pretty much 56 days, regression coefficients about 0.8. We start seeing rank correlations that get into the 90% range there. So needing more days on test to be able to accurately measure gain, and that becomes the crux, really, is that we need more days to accurately measure gain than we do to measure feed intake. So just kind of a reiteration of the current BIF standards here, and this is relevant for the next kind of literature review summary that Bob's going to talk about, which if some of you had the opportunity to listen to Ms. Ritalik in the committee session yesterday, some of this will be a bit of review, but I think certainly germane here, Bob.
Great. Thanks, Matt. And maybe before I get to that, one of the other sort of studies, Matt and I both serve on the USDA Feed Efficiency Project, and we had our advisory council meeting on Monday here in Biloxi. And Chris Cassidy, a student with Dan Shike at University of Illinois, many of you will recognize Dr. Shike. He's done a lot of work in the area of feed intake and feed efficiency, presented some similar data to what the Colorado State group has done, and really found somewhere between day 35 and day 42 those correlations or exceed 0.9, and as you progressively add weeks, of course, they get much closer. So there's a pretty nice body of knowledge developing around shortened test periods to measure feed intake, which we think is really important to have this sort of multiple replication of studies across institutions and certainly breeds and groups of cattle to support this, because we know that as we move out into industry, it's not going to be just testing in Angus or just testing in Charlet. It's going to be a number of different breeds in different locations. So that provides some more confidence to us, at least as we think about both the shortening of the test period, but also then thinking about this idea of decoupling the observations of feed intake and performance or gain. And so this is a little bit of summary data from Kelly Ritalik's talk yesterday in the Selection Decisions Group. Kelly's here. So, Kelly, if I misspeak, don't hesitate to jump up and down, okay, and set the professor straight. Kelly's worked on this project with Mike McNeil, Jennifer Borman, and the crew from Meat Animal Research Center. So we've been really fortunate to have an opportunity to work in this data in this area. Kelly's study really looked at a pretty good population of animals from Clay Center, both steers and heifers. So one of the things we wanted to investigate is the relationships between steers primarily fed on a high-concentrate diet versus heifers on a lower-energy density diet, and those relationships here illustrated on the diagonal elements represent the heritabilities, which were all pretty much in bounds for what we typically expect. A number of studies have observed some average daily gain estimates that are a little wonky, but certainly in the range of reported literature. The key thing, though, is really understanding that the thing we wanted to estimate was if we substitute average daily gain from the test program with a measurement of post-weaning gain, how are those related genetically? Are they really substitutes or proxies for each other, indicators, if you will, in our genetic evaluation system? And what we found was the relationship between steer post-weaning gain, so yearling weight less weaning weight adjusted, and with average daily gain from the test, a genetic correlation of 0.81, with a standard error of about 0.14. In heifers, a little bit lower, but certainly a strong positive association of about 0.7 nearly. And so we found that there was a good justification for decoupling those intake tests from the gain period, and recognized that in general, if we think about gain test, the variation we observe in both on-test weight and off-test weight associated with differences in gut fill have a pretty big influence on the measurements. And so the further you separate those, typically the difference between standard errors up or down on both ends relative to the amount of weight gain over the period helps insulate you against error and differences or variation in gut fill in those animals. And so, you know, post-weaning gain is an interval of roughly 150 days when we use adjusted weights to calculate that. Is much larger, almost double the typical average daily gain test period we would have for a feed intake trial. And so that provides, I think, some of the protection, if you will, or risk abatement relative to errors in measurement during a shortened test period. You know, if we coupled and looked at 35-day gain, you know, the standard errors are big enough that you could have animals that appear just because of measurement error to have no gain over the period when, in fact, they may have gained 3 pounds a day. And so the idea of really helping stretch those out, sort of an idea that's been floated around and we haven't talked a lot about yet in our committee, but I think is an interesting idea, is actually using the on and off test weights from the feed intake trial as additional data points in a random regression model for growth, right? So we get a better... We get more points to use in our prediction of growth or gain, and that could have some value in our system. But we really think adding, you know, additional data, not only, you know, when we go to calculate these feed intake predictions, we won't use just the representation of growth data from post-weaning gain of animals that have feed intake records. We use the whole database, and that provides additional accuracy and relationship connections across groups, and accounting potentially for some bias depending on how those groups were built to go into test. That we think is really important. I haven't spoken anything out of turn, have I, Matt? I'm on track? Okay. Got one step ahead here. This is the blue boxes here represent average daily gain and steer average daily gain genetic correlation about 4. So the relationship between sexes. If we look at heifer post-weaning gain and steer post-weaning gain, in that data represented about a 0.91 correlation. So quite a bit stronger, representing, you know, this post-weaning gain tends to be a little less variable maybe than the on-test average daily gain information. Part of the analysis that Kelly did for us was really going past the, okay, it's interesting if we can separate intake and gain, decouple those, but what effect does that have on selection efficiency or progress we might make in our system by basically enabling us to test quite a few more animals through the same facility without a diminished amount of information relative to the gain portion when we substitute post-weaning gain. And so she looked at both a 91-day and a 56-day test, so the shortened test period. We increased selection intensity. If you remember the breeder's equation, intensity is a key limiting step in our rate of progress or rate of change as we select for a trait. So the selection intensity goes from about a 2.06 to 2.27. If we look at the overall calculated change then in the index per generation, we see about almost a 25% increase in that rate of genetic progress. So we're able to test lots more animals, increase our selection intensity, and make more progress when we do that. Some other considerations, and Matt, we didn't really talk about splitting this part up very much, so I'll tackle some of it, and I'm sure there's some spots where you'll want to jump in. Mark talked a little bit about this idea of the warm-up period and the challenges that really presents depending on what kind of animals are going into the test facility. If we think about the goal of that warm-up period is really to reduce variation due to differences in background performance of those animals, what diet they were on before they arrived at the test. So we want to think about taking out things like compensatory gain, those things, getting the animals up on diet. And those all become very important because if they're not accounted for correctly or those animals don't aggregate together in terms of performance, then we have a bias in our test. that may favor one animal over another that's not actually based in terms of genetic merit as a reflection of management. And that's obviously a big problem that we try and avoid in our national cattle evaluation systems. The other portion is we want to make sure the animals are on the diet that they're going to enter the test on, so we don't have any differences or gastrointestinal upsets in those animals based on change in energy density in those diets. So going from a roughage or starter diet to a high concentrate diet shift right when you go to this feed intake trial is probably not a good idea. So we want to make sure we take care of those in this test period as well. One of the last things is this idea of differences, and some of the questions and comments that Mark made address this. There's a different learning curve for equipment used by the different or by animals in those different systems. So if we think about a Kalen gate system versus say an Instantec or GrowSafe system, quite a bit of difference in terms of learning curve for those animals to figure out where and how they can consume feed. Not to mention the idea that if they just show up at the test and they're not bunk broke and know how to go to a feed bunk and eat, we have lots of challenges in that area. So we want to make sure that as those cattle come on test, that we've taken care of a lot of that. And so I think as we develop the guidelines, we're going to try and make some recommendations relative to here's the objectives and here's our best recommendation for handling animals of different background and different experience in cases where we know that they've already been on feed for 40 days and they're on the same diet. That 40 days probably counts as warm-up period. And so we're going to try and make those sort of concepts as clear as we can because they have implications in terms of cost of the test and duration of the test that we know has an impact in y'all's production systems. Matt, maybe do you want to talk a little bit about we've talked at length about kind of contemporary grouping concepts both in our call and around the water cooler here, but really important concept that we need to focus on.
Now that we have an increasing number of feed intake facilities on farm or on ranch, whereby a producer can move an entire contemporary group from their operation through GrowSafe, some of these issues probably aren't quite as germane because we have fully intact contemporary groups. However, in the context of a centralized bull test station, this becomes a real issue. So we have far different management groups on ranch that are split and then sent on test and then admixed together. So really what we have are two separate contemporary groups. We have the one represented on ranch and then a different feeding contemporary group as they go through test. And so given the fact that as a committee right now we think there's a general lack of knowledge relative to the question, can we actually consider that group going through test, realizing that they came from dramatically different backgrounds, can we consider them as honestly a contemporary group? Our committee's talked about deferring to a much more conservative definition of a contemporary group. And so that's one that really should include the concatenation of the on-ranch group and the on-feed group. One thing that came up in our call to help accommodate that, in the ideal world, in our national cattle evaluation, we might actually want to fit the interaction between those two groups in NCE, but probably a better approach to conserve degrees of freedom would be to actually fit both those contemporary groups in the model. And one thing that does help us do is it avoids throwing away or discarding a lot of potential data that could come from very small contemporary groups, because we do understand that this is still an expensive trait relative to others to measure. So those are some things we talked about. Another thing to consider, we're talking about the use of feed intake phenotypes to enter into national cattle evaluation. The other flip side of the coin is these phenotypes are obviously critical in the development and further refinement of genomic predictions for feed intake and feed efficiency. So if we have a centralized bull test unit, my presumption is that the majority of cattle sent there are pre-selected for something. I seriously doubt producers randomly select bulls to go to a centralized test unit. And so that is a bit concerning as we think about utilizing those phenotypes then for further refinement of genomic predictions. The flip side is, if I'm a rancher, I own a GrowSafe, the primary reason I have it is I want to run my cattle through. And so if I happen to be, and I'll use just a purely fictitious example, I'm a very large breeder in a very small breed. The only feed intake records coming through are from my cattle. As a consequence, any resulting genomic predictions for feed intake are going to work very well in my cattle, and they are not likely going to be robust to the larger population. So these kinds of things are a concern, I believe, as we start thinking about not only how we group cattle, but also the utility of some of the field data that could potentially come in. So I think I already talked about most of this before. And so maybe to quickly summarize, obviously the committee thinks that we can not only decouple feed intake and weight records on test, we think when we do that, we can shorten the length of test to get accurate dry matter intake records and leverage the plethora of post-weaning gain records that already exist in NCE. There's obviously some other issues that we maybe don't have enough information to truly quantify yet, and those are things related to altering warm-up period. We believe it's important and feel the most comfortable staying with something that's more conservative, realizing there's differences between feed intake systems, and the same thing relative to contemporary groups. We feel that being more conservative in that definition is probably more advantageous or at least advisable at this point. So I suppose questions can be directed to any of the committee members in here.